I'm Faith Middleton with Rich Hanley of Quinnipiac University, and this is a fresh edition of Politics, Burgers, and Beer in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. We thank you so much for listening. Rich, as you know, Senator Bernie Sanders will be our guest a little bit later on in the show. He's going in right now for a couple of votes, and as soon as he gets out, he's racing right to a phone, and we're going to have him on the show. Regarding what's going on, we're just listening to the NPR news headlines regarding what's going on in Tokyo at the moment. You spoke to a student of yours at Quinnipiac University whose parents are in the disaster region.
Right. Yeah, I was one of our graduates. So I was fortunate to have a student of mine. And I contacted him to see how he was doing, how his family was doing, in particular, because I knew where they were from. And he told me he's fine, everything's fine. But what struck me was what he reported about his mother's reaction to the earthquake. His mother reported to him that she felt it was over and that she had accepted death as inevitable because of the quake and the subsequent tsunami. And, you know that just struck me as, indicative of perhaps the moment when, nature arrays its forces against you. And she had, in that moment, thought it'd be inevitable that she would die, but she didn't, fortunately, and she's okay. But now just amplify that many, many times over with the nuclear menace, and you get, I think, a good sense of the psyche of the people in Japan right now.
I have two things that have just been handed to me within the last 30 minutes. These are two different news reports. One of them says, this is from the Los Angeles Times, radiation will reach California on Friday. The one in my left hand says, U.S. officials, no radiation danger to the U.S. and its territories. So this is, not only is there confusion in Japan, but there is confusion, purposeful or not, here in the United States.
There seems to be a startling lack of data, given the instrumentation and one that can measure these sorts of things. But regardless, the psychological menace created by the expression radioactive plume, whether it harms U.S. citizens or not, exists. And people will be changed by that fact on the ground is that there is a sense of menace whenever there's a radioactive moving your way, radioactive cloud moving your way or plume. I think this spells a concern about the future of nuclear energy in the United States, whether we, or ever build another plant again, just the fact that this plume, which is thousands of miles away, will arrive on our shores, by the end of the week, or if the winds shift, maybe later, I think is putting a psychological trench in any sense that nuclear power will rebound the United States.
Well, in the story that says radiation will reach California on Friday, this is a story in the Los Angeles Times that I've just been handed, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission released computerized projections showing that within half a mile of the plant in Tokyo, radiation levels were so high that one could receive a fatal dose, and that even 50 miles away, one could receive more than 16 times the average annual dose all people are exposed to from natural resources. But here's the key. It says, so far, Tokyo Electric Power Company, which operates the Fukushima facility, and the Japanese government have not released any measurements or estimates of the total amount of radioactivity released by the accident. These numbers would be crucial to better project whether the material could affect other Asian nations, the Pacific Islands, or even the U.S. Now, they talked to an Edwin Lyman, who's a specialist at the nuclear watchdog group Union of Concerned Scientists, and he said, yes, it's true, there's more radioactivity released in Japan, and more could migrate away from the region, but he did not think that the U.S. was at serious risk. And here's his quote, "We can never say never," Lyman said. "My judgment is that there will probably be measurable radiation, but except for a few hot spots, it is not something we should really worry about."
Unless, so, of course, you're in one of those hot spots.
Well, yeah. The question, of course, is what does that mean? Where are these hot spots?
Yeah, I just think it all depends on the wind and the way it's projected across the United States. And I think that the danger or the damage, you know, won't be physical. I mean, it's a long, long ways away. And from what I'm reading in the scientific literature, it's you know, pretty well dispersed by the time it crosses the Pacific Ocean. Nevertheless, there is a clear psychological toll in this.
Huge.
Yeah, and I think that is the story in the United States, in terms of this nuclear disaster in Japan, is that, you know, we have to reassess where we are in terms of energy overall. I mean, in the last 9 months, what have been the two big stories? You know, Deepwater Horizon, you know, an oil well that blew up, you know, in the Gulf of Mexico and spilled millions and millions of gallons, destroyed all sorts of wildlife, almost wrecked an industry in Louisiana and in the southern tier of the United States. And now this Japanese disaster triggered by the earthquake and tsunami. So I think we have right now a moment in time where we're looking at the past 9 months and we have these two enormous disasters, and both are focused on energy, how we get it and how we use it. And so the conversation, I think, now shifts to what do we do now? You know, what now, that sang Plato's ghost, as Yeats wrote. What now? What do you do? You know, we drill deeper in the ocean. It's creating a tremendous danger. We build nuclear plants. There's an earthquake and tsunami. We have radioactive plumes spanning the Pacific Ocean. How much a trade-off are we willing to make in terms of cheap electricity, fuel, et cetera, for our safety? I think that's the question that needs to be addressed.
They had an expert on a particular news show that I was watching yesterday. I've been cruising through everything and getting this, it's just like what I hold in my hands, these two opposite statements of there is danger, there is no danger. So various experts saying various things, and one of them said something interesting. He said, let me just explain to you. He said, I've worked in the nuclear power industry. Here's what's really going on. You've got people on one side demanding that for our nuclear power plants here in the United States, and this goes around in other countries too, but here in the United States, all these people concerned with safety demanding that these measures be taken to make our plants safer, and as we build them, to do these various things. He said, then you have the industry over here, and they're blocking these requests for instituting these safety measures, because if you did them all and you were an investor in this business, you could not make money. And so it's almost a little bit like the NRA. If we allow one thing, we're going to get swamped and the whole thing's going to be a mess and we're not going to make any money. And so the industry has a kind of wall up saying no, no, no to as many safety measures as they can. This is his explanation.
Right.
Because they're fearful of what this is going to cost and whether it's going to drain profits out of what is a business to them, versus other people who are saying, you know, say anything, say the word radiation, everybody's scared to death. These things have to be done because this is hard to recover from if this goes down. And we've got these plants, of course, and the industry is saying these plants are 40 and 50 years old. What are you talking about? Look, we haven't had a problem. And the safety people are saying, exactly, the plants are 40 and 50 years old. What does that say to you? So this is the kind of debate that we're hearing right now. Well,
yeah.
I thought from inside the industry, that was a very good comment.
I think that's terrific, because it points at a sharp relief, you know, the trade-offs that need to be made, the compromises that need to be made. If you want energy that's cheap for all, you have to make compromises somewhere, and it may be in the safety area of nuclear plants. So you'll take the risk. Like we do with automobiles, we accept, 40,000 traffic deaths a year for the mobility the automobile provides. And if the auto companies want to, you know, engineer a 100% safe automobile, are we willing to pay what would be an extraordinary price for that automobile? And we say, no, we're not willing to pay for it. So we're willing to accept 40,000 traffic deaths a year, or whatever the number is, for the capacity to be mobile. And it's the same with energy. If we want energy, I mean, it's just almost, you know, tragic to recall back in the 50s, the idea that nuclear power was, quote, too cheap to meter, end quote, when they weren't considering the safety precautions that were needed when they built plants. And we see that it may be too expensive to meter based on the human toll we may be seeing in Japan and elsewhere. So as a nation, where are we going to get our energy? Well, if we want nuclear plants, then we're going to have to pay a lot for it because you got to put these containment structures in and you got to have backups on backups and backups and backups. And even then, it's still not a fail-safe system.
I mean, what are we going to do about the plants that are built on fault lines?
Well, I guess the plant in California is the one that a lot of folks are looking at. I believe it's called the Diablo Canyon.
I think there are three or four on fault lines.
Yeah, and you just hope and or have confidence. I don't want to use the word hope because hope doesn't get us anything. We need confidence in the engineering and the people who engineered those plants that they did do their job properly, and I have no reason to think they didn't, that they can withstand an earthquake and they do have backup systems that do work. I mean, in the Japanese case, it was the failure of the electricity, oddly enough, that caused the pumping issues that led to the heat and radioactive plumes, you know, radiating from the plant. So, you know, maybe the retrofitting just needs to be looked at, I think, very cautiously. At the same time, Americans want electricity. They got to get it. Have to get it from somewhere.
Yeah. We're going to open the phones. We'd love to get your comments. Of course, Senator Bernie Sanders is going to join us on the show. He's in the chamber right now voting. As soon as he's done with that, he's joining the show. We'd love to have you join the conversation now at 203-776-9677. 203-776-9677. Here on this fresh edition of Politics, Burgers, and Beer with Rich Hanley, I'm Faith Middleton, and we'll be right back. Faith Middleton, thanks so much for listening. With Rich Hanley of Quinnipiac University, you're listening to this fresh edition of Politics, Burgers, and Beer. As I mentioned, Senator Bernie Sanders will join us as soon as he is done with a couple of votes. He's in the middle of, at this moment, he's done a book called The Speech, which was actually about his historic filibuster on corporate greed and the decline of the middle class. So wait till we get to that topic. We do have lots of callers in reaction to some of the things we've been talking about so far on the show. Kyle, Faith Middleton, and Rich Hanley, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to bring into the conversation the issues that arise from any other sources of power that we currently use. How many coal miners have died over the decades, centuries? What are the second and third order effects of the emissions, both CO2 and otherwise, of the environment, versus the comparatively small amount of damage that has occurred because of nuclear power? And taking a look at the risks from the perspective of the potential for disaster versus the impact of that disaster. And I think that in the aggregate, we're not really reacting emotionally rather than rationally to the dangers that exist from nuclear power.
No, I think Kyle's absolutely right. And that's the psychological menace, you know, I referenced at the top of the show. It may not be a physical danger to the West Coast, but the ideas in people's minds that it is. And I know, I just think that Kyle's argument is one that the nuclear power industry really needs to make. In terms of it, the aggregate, I like that. I like the use of that word.
Well,
I thought it was perfect.
I'll tell you this. I saw someone from the industry on a news show the other day, and my jaw was hanging open because this person tried to make the case that wind turbines are very dangerous. And this woman said from the industry, the nuclear power industry, you know, you could be walking by and a blade could snap off and kill you. And I saw the reporter's mouth fall open, and they immediately didn't know what to do, and they turned to somebody else. And I thought, is this the best the nuclear power industry can do, is to send out someone who would make a comment like that when people are dealing with the kind of psychological terror that the word radiation creates in people.
Right. I mean, we've been, through this with Three Mile Island. You know, granted, it was in the 70s, but there was that great fear that induced Chernobyl.
Chernobyl
in the 80s.
Is,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Here we are. Chernobyl was very real.
Right, right.
And we're still dealing with the effects of that. A lot of people died.
Yeah, I don't think, people understand that the Chernobyl reactor was dramatically less safe than the American reactors in terms of containment structures. I'm not a nuclear expert. I'm not going to get into that. Let a nuclear scientist explain. But it was a different type of reactor. That said, you're talking about technical distinctions that don't enter the psychological realm of the discussion because of the fear factor and just the expression radioactive plume or radioactive cloud, and people associate that negatively. I think that Kyle's point is well taken and is one that needs to be raised, I think, in all quarters, but also the whole idea of conservation of energy. Clearly there are dangers in everything. And we do, and now we have to say, well, if we don't use as much energy as we have in the past, perhaps there can be alternatives developed that will help us get through what we need to get through without putting everyone at substantial risk.
Of course, the conversation has, because everybody's scared, has shifted so much to what are we going to do here in America with our plants, and we've skipped over the astonishing pictures that we're seeing and what's happening to the Japanese people. I've never in my life seen anything like these pictures I've seen, and I don't think there's just no more crying to be done. I mean, it's just unbelievable to see it.
There's been a lot of sadness in the world recently.
Yeah. Anthony, Faith Middleton with Rich Hanley, welcome to the show.
Oh, and thank you so much for having me, Faith, and I greatly appreciate all the programming that NPR provides.
Thank you.
I got quite a few points I'd love to be able to make, but most importantly is that there was a law that by 1996, I believe it was, they were supposed to be restoring all the waste products from these energy reactors mm-hmm. in Yucca Mountain or something, and they won't put it there because they say the mountain's too unstable and it's not a safe repository now. So why is it then safe to store it on ocean fronts, mountain cliffs, fault lines? And, it seems it's more dangerous to have it above ground than to put it below ground, but they don't want to take it below ground because it's not safe. So therefore, it does not belong on this planet because it's just going to be eventually some way, shape, or form create situations such as this. And I do believe that the gravity of this situation is being downplayed because you have six reactors, not to mention all the waste that is being stored right alongside of them, that is just going to turn into one huge molten mess that nobody can go near. They're all going to combine together right into the Pacific Ocean. And this is the end of times. They're downplaying it, but this is 2012.
Well, why do you think, though, that so many scientists are coming forward? I was reading some of the remarks, not only from our own scientists, but from scientists around the world who do not paint as dark a picture as you have painted. And this is their calling. This is what they do for a living. Why is that happening?
Well, I do believe that they are all from the industry, and they have a vested interest in allowing this industry to proliferate. I mean, let's face it. These scientists, with all their knowledge, they're just book readers. They don't really have a grasp, I don't think, of the magnitude of what they have created with this nuclear industry throughout the world. And the reactors that we gave to Japan, General Electric, where are they in all this? General Electric gave those, they knew those things were antiquated when they sold them to them. They were actually supposed to be used in the American market, and they dumped them on Japan because they knew that the technology had evolved to a safer design. So they just sold off their garbage to Japan and left them holding the bag. And where's the IAEA? How come they're not inspecting these sites to see that the waste is not stored properly? And what you're having now is there's such a tremendous amount of heat created in this instance that it's boiling off all the water. You can dump this is going to boil the Pacific Ocean dry. And there's doubt in my mind that that's what's going to happen.
First of all, I want to thank you so much for adding your comments to the show. I appreciate it very, very much. I wish I could comment on the technicalities of how this works, but I don't understand I don't understand how these plants operate in depth. I don't understand how this waste material sitting by the plants functions. I don't understand whether it would, in fact, bleed the ocean dry. I don't know. But, you know, we're all concerned. We're trying to get as many facts assembled here on the ground as we possibly can. And we're having a conversation among ourselves now as citizens. We're getting comments from people not only within the industry, the nuclear industry right now, you know, across our media, but also people from outside the industry who are, you know, have been on the other side and have been calling for safety. Now, some of those people are saying they agree that we're not in vital danger in the United States, and that there may be some underreporting over-reporting about the dangers to certain people. You know, even people in the safety community are saying this. So it's a very confusing thing. The target is moving all over the place, and we're doing the best we can trying to assemble as many facts as we can. I opened the show by holding two different news reports in my hand within the last half hour that had come out. One says, a headline, radiation will reach California on Friday, and the other one says, U.S. officials, no radiation danger to the U.S. territories. Now, within these releases, there are some things that do make my eyebrows shoot up.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
there are going to be some hot spots. I don't know what that means.
That should have been elaborated upon.
Yeah. Linda, Faith Middleton with Rich Hanley, welcome to Politics, Burgers, and Beer. And please don't forget that in just a while, Senator Bernie Sanders is going to be joining us here on the show by phone. Linda, go ahead.
Hi, Faith. I'm not a, you know, don't have a scientific perspective to offer, just a human perspective, but I'm sort of probably like a lot of people sitting here kind of watching this unfold with horror. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess, you know, what I would say is, you know, whether the risk is worth taking probably depends on whether you're the one that it's happening to. And honestly, I'm a conservative person. I would not even want to have to think that, you know, having two kids, that I would ever have to be faced with what people in Japan are facing right now. The other thing I want to say is I don't think we're nearly creative enough in this country or, I don't know what the right word is, but I guess I would use the word unselfish enough to really be looking at alternative forms of energy. My mom lives on Cape Cod. She's an environmentalist, and she's attended a lot of the meetings out there with respect to the wind power.
Yes.
And she said she's been at those meetings and have, you know, it's, in a lot of cases, it's just a matter of selfishness. Like, people don't want to look out over the coastline and see these things off the coastline. I just think, you know, we need to be more creative in our thinking. You know, we need to focus less on things like profit and what matters to each of us individually and what's better for everyone is, you know, for the greater good. And safety. That's just my opinion.
Thank you very much. It's great to have your voice on the show. I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, I mean, we want electricity for all, but it has to be generated somehow, somewhere. And people don't want to look out their window and see windmills. I mean, to meet the capacity for generation that a nuclear plant can offer in terms of windmill power, I think it would be staggering, you know, in terms of how at least nuclear power is reliable in the sense that it does generate a steady stream of electricity.
But it's just a small piece of the...
But it's I mean, just safety is, you know, the safety has to be paramount when you're handling, you know, the radioactive world, if you will. And I think the scientists and engineers have done a pretty good job of learning over time on it. I mean, let's not forget that it took an earthquake and a tsunami to knock out the power, which precluded water from being pumped that generated this incident. And even in the worst case scenarios, I don't know if that was part of the storyline, you know, a 1-2 punch like that. So,
you know,
it's just got to be, I think, paramount despite the cost and something like
that. Do you find yourself, let's do this on a personal level. Do you find yourself, Rich Hanley, thinking about being surrounded by plants at this very moment? Do you think we have one right over here in Westchester? We have one, Rhode Island, we're surrounded by these plants. And I think, because this is going on, it's all of a sudden, I can forget about that.
Right.
You know, I can read articles within the past year, and I think, you know, maybe we should revisit this idea of nuclear power plants. And now we see this going on, and everybody's asking hard questions again. And I'm especially thinking, I'm surrounded by these plants right now.
Yeah, and we're surrounded by the electricity these plants provide in terms of our devices and now our cars as we shift from gasoline-powered engines to electrical engines. We're going to need more electricity for the Chevy Volt of the world and the Toyota Priuses of the world.
But I'm trying to say it's scary.
I'm also the fact that we drive over natural gas pipelines, it's generally safe.
But it's making me think. Do you know what's making me think?
Yeah.
I think, what if another nation went to war with us? What would happen? Or with some other country? France has a million nuclear power plants
now. Right, yes, yes.
Okay? So what happens if missiles are shot into the nuclear power plants and they explode into a million pieces and there are all these core meltdowns? What happens?
Well, the worst case scenario happens. That is, you have a release of a radioactive plume that's far
more devastating
that cannot be controlled, contained.
More devastating than anything else.
Well, I'm not going to lose sleep over that happening, but we do need to understand, I think, that if we wish to have electricity that's affordable for all and a distribution system that gets it to the furthest corner of the nation with reliability, we have to take risks to generate that electricity. If we don't want to take those risks, then we have to understand we may not have the power we need.
Where is the agency that people can trust?
That's a great
to
question.
Give us good information
great
about
question.
All this.
Great question.
We'll be right back in 90 seconds with more politics, burgers, and beer in this upcoming section. We hope Senator Bernie Sanders gets out of his vote to join us to talk about his book and protecting the middle class. Thank you so much for staying with us. We'll be right back. I'm Faith Middleton. Thanks so much for listening. Wanted to let you know that the renowned modern artist Caio Fonseca, who lives on the east end of Long Island, will have a show of new paintings there April 8th through May 23rd, opening reception Saturday, April 9th from 5 to 7 at one of my favorite galleries on the east end, The Drawing Room on Newtown Lane in East Hampton, New York. Go online to drawingroomgallery.com. We have with us now, and it is such a pleasure, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who is author of this book, The Speech. It is the text of his historic filibuster on corporate greed and the decline of our middle class. It crashed when that speech was going on, crashed all the servers across Washington and in Congress. So many people wanted to hear what he had to say. So welcome to Politics, Burgers, and Beer, Senator Sanders.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So the Republican Party is proposing $61 billion in cuts. Is this going to change things significantly? Is this going to create jobs as they're now saying it's going to do?
No. One of the concerns that I have is a lot of people don't know what is in those cuts. And in fact, it is a savage, and I use the word advisedly, a savage attack against working families, the middle class, and lower-income people. Just to give you a few examples, we're talking under the Republican past budget, throwing over 200,000 kids off of Head Start. Now, we have a crisis in terms of early childhood education today. There is absolutely not enough affordable, quality child care. The idea that in this moment, in the midst of a recession, when working families and lower-income people are struggling, mm-hmm. that you throw 200,000 kids off of Head Start is incomprehensible. What they also want to do is either reduce or eliminate Pell Grants for millions of college students at a time when college education is soaring. They want to cut back on the Social Security Administration at a time when that administration is already too slow in getting out the payments owed to eligible Americans. They want to make a 30% reduction in the Environmental Protection Agency, and that's the agency, obviously, that enforces the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. They want to cut back on child care. They want to cut back on the Women, Infant, and Children program, which provides nutritional benefits, food, nutrition, to pregnant women, low-income pregnant women, and little babies. And on and on and on it goes. Those are just some of the cuts. It is a fierce attack against lower-income and moderate-income people. And at the same time, they continue to fight for more tax breaks for the richest people in this country at a time when the wealthiest people are doing phenomenally well.
Hi, Senator. Rich Hanley from Quinnipiac University. I have some family in Vermont. My brother's chief of police of Middlebury, and they all speak very highly of you.
Thank you.
What do you propose we can do about this deficit? Is there any plan to raise taxes or just what do you propose we do?
Well, here's the feeling, and I think it is shared by the overwhelming majority of the American people. You need what I call shared sacrifice. Do we need to make cuts in government? Absolutely. But what we also need to say to the wealthiest people in this country who are doing very, very well, whose effective tax rate now is the lowest on record, it's a little over 16%. So you have the wealthiest people paying an effective tax rate that is lower than many teachers or nurses. And these guys have received hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks in the last few years. It is absolutely incredible to me that we are not asking those folks to help us with deficit reduction. You can't just do it by throwing children off of Head Start. So we have proposed a surtax on millionaires, that is, on households that are earning more than $1 million. They would pay a 5.4% surtax. We have also proposed doing away with some of the loopholes in tax law that enable large oil companies, who have also done phenomenally well in recent years, to avoid, in some cases, paying any federal income taxes at all. So I think if you just impose a surtax on the wealthiest people in this country, you can bring in up to $50 million, and you can bring in even more by doing away with some of the loopholes that the oil companies now have.
You know, I have seen, Senator Saunders, a pivot in the last week. I saw your colleague, Eric Cantor, standing up yesterday morning, saying the reason that our Republican Party is calling for these cuts and reduction in the deficit to the extent that we are is to create jobs. Before this, they were talking about cuts, 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 deficit, 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 no link to jobs. Somebody in the messaging department has gotten to the Republican Party, and there's been this pivot, and they're now linking those two things. And I wonder if you think this is going to be more effective for the Republican Party and with the American people.
Well, I think the reason that they're doing that is that there have been independent studies out there that suggest that when you cut back on Head Start and on education and on Pell Grants and on Social Security, the end result is, according to some independent studies, that you lose about 700,000 jobs in the process. And so I think that they are sensitive to that. And they're going back to the old trickle-down theory of economics, that if you give tax breaks to the richest people, somehow or another it's going to create all kinds of jobs. I don't think most people believe that.
What about what's going on in state governments in certain areas of the country, Senator? There seems to be a capacity at the state level to breach contracts at will. And I say contracts, I mean collective bargaining agreements reached in good faith between two parties negotiating at arm's length. That, to me, suggests a certain lawlessness that's occurring during this period of deficit reduction at the state level, at least, where they're not honoring agreements that were reached in good faith by both parties. What's your take on what's going on at the state level?
I wouldn't use the word lawlessness. What I would suggest, and that's what I talked a lot about in my speech and what's in the book, is people have to take a step back and understand that right now the middle class and working families of our country are under extreme assault. And what I've been describing here in Washington, tax breaks for billionaires and cutbacks on programs that middle class and working families desperately need is one part of it. What's going on at state government is another part of it. In terms of the attacks on public unions, for example, that has, in my view, nothing to do with deficit reduction. That is simply an effort in Wisconsin and elsewhere to try to destroy unions who are effective political opponents, the right-wing Republicans. But if you add the attacks against organized labor and public employees unions, if you talk about the attacks against the middle class and the cutbacks on many, many programs, the attacks we're seeing against Social Security and Medicare, and then you add to that the Citizens United decision by a 5-4 vote last year, which gives large corporations the right to play a very, very active role in political campaigns for the first time without any disclosure. Yet add all of that together, and what you're looking at is a major attack by the very wealthiest people in this country and their supporters against working families. And all of this, if I may say, takes place in a context where the middle class is already shrinking, poverty is already increasing, and the gap between the very rich and everybody else is already getting wider.
On the other hand, Senator, there are these huge deficits in the states. The pension funds in so many states are broke. I mean, zero. To Rich's point about you just can't change agreements that have been made in good faith, states are all looking at what to do for the new workers and how to change things. It's a pretty dismal picture out there. What do we do?
Well, it is a dismal picture. You're right. But I think to do the right thing, and I'm not suggesting that I have all the answers, though I know anybody who does have all the answers, but I think you got to look at a couple of things. Number one, the Republicans want to take us back to the trickle-down economic theory, and that is tax breaks for the rich, unfettered free trade, deregulation. Well, we went through that during Bush's 8 years. That was the philosophy. The result is that we had the most dismal economic performance in modern American history. We actually lost some 500,000 or 600,000 private sector jobs. It didn't really work very well. The rich got much richer, but it really did not work very well for ordinary people. Second of all, a lot of what we're seeing now takes place within the context of, gee, we have a very large deficit and a $14 trillion national debt. We've got to do something about that. Well, I agree that we do, but it's also important to take a step back and say, okay, how did we get into this deficit situation in the first place? Is it really the fault of teachers or public employees in Wisconsin? And I think if you look at how we got into where we are right now, number one, it is the Wall Street-caused recession, which took place because of the deregulation of Wall Street, something that I opposed very strongly when I was in the House. And second of all, the deficit, that's how you got into the immediate economic situation you're in. If you want to go back a little bit further and ask how we got into the deficit situation, it is two wars unpaid for. It is a Medicare Part D prescription drug program written by the insurance companies unpaid for. Wall Street bailout unpaid for, and tax breaks for the wealthy. So those are the factors, the causes of where we are right now, to punish the middle class, to punish public employees, to renege on agreements made to those workers seems to me to be absolutely wrong.
Let me tell you what happened on Friday, December 10th. We're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, and I'm holding in my hands this book, The Speech, and it's about his historic filibuster on corporate greed and the decline of our middle class. It's the text of the filibuster speech that he made on Friday, December 10th. It galvanized millions of Americans because I know, Senator Sanders, as you explain in the book, you went out with a few papers, but you didn't know how long you were going to talk, and it lasted for 8.5 hours and was riveting for so many people that all the servers were crashing in Washington, so many people. So it is now, that speech is now published in this book, and you can read every word of it. I read it last night.
And, did you? Did you enjoy it?
Yes, I did very, very much because I thought, well, this is Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. I thought about what I would say if I stood up there and had a few pieces of paper in front of me and had started talking off the top of my head about what I really feel. And I could go maybe for an hour, but I don't know if I could go for 8.5 hours. It was really amazing. What were you going to say?
No, that's fine. You could, believe me, once you get going, you can do better than that. So, And it wasn't all off the top of my head. I had, you know, over the years on many of the issues that I discussed, not only the decline of the middle class and unfettered free trade and after and permanent normal trade relations with China, but the need for a national health care program, the need to rebuild our infrastructure and put people to work, the need to transform our energy system. I mean, those are all issues that, that I have been talking about for years, and this gave me the opportunity, if you like, to put it all together.
So I'm watching President Obama, and you talk about him in the book, too, because he has had to compromise, and he certainly is going to have to compromise in the months ahead. And I wonder, you know, what's your advice to him? What do you do with a Republican House and this the Tea Party, which is really on the extreme? What do you do if you're president? How do you advise him?
Well, Senator? I hesitate. You know, the president has so many responsibilities. I mean, you know, look at, I mean, you know, what's going on in Japan today, what's going on in Libya today, and, I mean, enormous series of problems that the president has. I'm hesitant to give advice, but here's what I think, what politics is about, or at least the way I practice politics. To my mind, what you have to use the bully pulpit for, whether you're the president or a senator, is to try to explain to people as best you can why we are where we are right now. What are the causes of the problems? And what I have been very disappointed in the president is that he has not really done a good job recently in educating the American people as to what's going on and trying to rally them in opposition to right-wing extremism. In other words, if you take the case to the American people, and the polling is pretty clear about this, this is not just my thoughts, this is what the polls reflect, and you say to them, should we simply move toward deficit reduction by attacking programs desperately needed by working families or lower-income people, or should we ask for shared sacrifice, ask the wealthiest people in this country to also contribute to deficit reduction? The polling numbers are overwhelming. People say, of course we have got to ask the wealthy. But the president has not done a good job on that. What he has preferred to do is take the position that he doesn't want conflict, that we can all sit down and work together. And the end result, I fear, I hope I'm wrong, the end result in terms of the continuing resolution that we're working on right now and the 2012 budget resolution will be significant cuts, that the Republican narrative will prevail. They won't get everything that they want, but it will prevail. And on every initiative that the Republicans are pushing very hard, the president is saying, well, I'm not going to go that far, but I'll go, you know, two-thirds of the way. And I think when you do that, you're not explaining to the American people why we got to where we are today and really what an alternative direction might be.
Can you do that in the world we're living in? With the way we have so many channels, so many bloggers, it's not like Edward R. Murrow sits down in a chair and makes a dramatic speech to the nation. Can he get, you know...
That is an excellent point. That is a very, very good point, but it speaks to another issue. And that is to the degree to which narrative has been established by Fox News, the Fox Network, and by right-wing radio. And I think people underestimate. What you're really asking me is whether a president can stand up to Rush Limbaugh and all these guys on the radio, and Fox, which not only has a network, the Republicans not only have a network of their own, but don't underestimate the impact that Fox has on the corporate media, the mainstream media. And you're asking me a very interesting question. If Rush Limbaugh keeps pounding away on an issue, can the president really withstand that? I think a strong president can, but it is tough, and it raises fundamental questions about media and why 90% of talk radio, for example, is extreme right wing.
There on this show, we've been talking for you know, a year about how curious it is that this eloquent man, who is the president of the United States, has been so bereft in the messaging department, as opposed to a quite brilliant messaging campaign from his opposition. What's going on there, do you think?
Well, I think you raise, again, a very good point. I thought the campaign that Barack Obama ran when he became president was the best campaign that I've ever seen in my lifetime. I thought it was brilliant. I thought that he was extraordinarily effective in not only using the new technologies out there, but inspiring young people, minorities, working class people. It was really a brilliant campaign. I think what has happened is the president, and I'm speculating here, I'm not much into speculating. I think he has made a decision that he thinks the way he wins re-election is by going after some of these moderate to conservative independent voters rather than inspiring people who might otherwise not turn out and vote, lower-income people.
But don't the independents win elections?
Not if you have, well, first of all, I am the longest-serving independent in the history of the United States Congress. So, you know, it's an issue I know a little bit about. And I think independents want to hear a president be a strong leader, speak his mind, let the chips fall where they may, and not simply quietly compromise with right-wing extremism. Mm-hmm. And I think where the president may have a big surprise in store for him when he runs for re-election is that that enormous grassroots army of people that he had campaigning for him when he won may not be there. I can tell you, I do a talk show every Friday afternoon on the Tom Hartman Show, and it's we talk to a couple of million people. And every Friday I hear just a lot of disappointment and less and less enthusiasm for the president. So I think he will be surprised that at the grassroots level there are a lot of folks who will not be working very, very hard. They may well be voting for him, but it's not going to be the kind of excitement that we saw in his initial election.
Well, they certainly didn't show up for the midterm elections.
Right.
And so I think that's strong evidence in support of that view. But what can in the Congress, Senator, what can be done to forge some sort of compromise between the reality of our fiscal situation, you know, and the need to take care of people who can't take care of themselves, who need government help? Is there an atmosphere where there's a sense of morality in play that a compromise can be forged so that agreements can be
made? I look at it a little bit differently. Again, you know, my politics is different than most of the other people in the Senate. What I look at is the need to make the case to the American people and have the American people put pressure on their elected officials. Right now, obviously, you have a right-wing House of Representatives, very, very conservative, and you have a pretty conservative Senate as well. And I think what we have got to do, what political leaders have got to do, is make the case to the American people that, yes, deficit reduction is extremely important, but you have to do it in a fair way, shared sacrifice. At the same time as we talk about moving toward deficit reduction, you cannot forget today, and it's not talked about too often, do you know what real, R-E-A-L, real unemployment is in America today? If you include those people who have given up looking for work and those people working part-time who want to work full-time, do you know what that number is? It's about 16%. Hmm. And in some parts of the country, it's even higher than that. You can't forget about that. You have got to keep going. I just met earlier today with the Secretary of Transportation, Ray LaHood, and we talked about the need for massive investments in our infrastructure, in our roads, in our bridges, in our tunnels, in our rail, which creates jobs and improves the quality of life in America and our international competitiveness. You got to talk about those things. You got to talk about.
Well, we'll see if that conversation starts to happen. Thank you so much for being with us. We're out of time on the show. It's a pleasure to have you.
Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity.
Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, his book is called The Speech About, it's word for word, his historic filibuster on corporate greed and the decline of our middle class in Congress, the one that crashed all the servers. The Faith Middleton Show airs at 3 and 9 p.m. on WNPR. Thanks to Rich Hanley of Quinnipiac University on this fresh edition of Politics, Burgers, and Beer. Check us out on Facebook. Just search The Faith Middleton Show. Thanks to our talented producers, Jonathan McNichol, and senior producer, Lori Mack. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.